please the court, Mr. Leon Hoffman and Mr. James McCartney will present arguments for the petitioner. Mr. Leon Hoffman will open.
Please the court, my name is Leon Hoffman. I'm representing the petitioner, Sun Exploration and Production Company. Mr. McCartney is representing the petitioner, Amatil Production Company. We've decided to split the opening time. I propose to restrict as best I can my comments to the issues in this case that relate directly to the implied covenants of the oil and gas lease. And generally, Mr. McCartney proposes to comment on the issues in this case that relate principally to the remedies for breach of implied covenants, that is the conditional and unconditional cancellation, lease cancellation features that have been raised on the case. I have one preliminary comment I would like to make, Your Honors, and this relates to our first point of error, which was not a point of error on which the writ of error was granted, and I don't propose to argue the matter, but I would, in behalf of my client, like to remind the court that the first point of error is in the case, and we consider it a very important one. I'll mention it and leave it very quickly, but this does have to do with our assertion that the trial judge was disqualified in this case. First and foremost, as we presented in our briefs in some detail, he was disqualified, we say, under Article 5 of the state constitution and Article 15 of the state statute, because he was connected with a party to the case within the third degree. In this instance, we're asserting that one of the trial counsel, who is a first cousin of the trial judge, is a party within the meaning of the statute and within the meaning of the cases that have construed the statute, particularly on account of attorney's fees having been requested in the case and granted in the judgment. As I say, I just wanted to remind the court that that issue is in the case.
Let's talk about that for just a second. Other than the fact that the trial judge approved attorney's fees, is there any other allegation of interest on the part of the attorney to make him a, quote, party within the Constitution?
No, sir, we don't allege any other basis than the matter of the attorney's fees.
So it's because the judge was related within the third degree to an attorney in the case, and the judge got to set the fee of the attorney. You're saying that the judge was disqualified?
Yes, sir. That, we're saying that, that the attorney fee matter in the case caused the attorney to be a party within the meaning of the statute as the statute has been.
Do you have any case where that has been that theory has been expanded outside of a workers' compensation context?
Yes, sir. We cite and discuss several cases.
Which one is those? Not by style of case, but by areas of law.
Well, I recall, Your Honor, that several cases, some three or four, involve divorce matters where the attorneys, not all involving a judge's disqualification, but all involving cases where the attorney was held to be a party for various purposes. And they were not workers' compensation cases. And we're relating those cases to Article 15 of the statutes and taking the position that that causes his attorney to be a party at the trial level.
So you're contending that all these proceedings are just void from the beginning?
Well, yes, we're contending that the judgment was void. And I'm supposed to have that effect. And now, Your Honors, to the issues under the points of error on which writ of error was granted. This suit has to do with whether an oil and gas lease can be canceled either conditionally or unconditionally under any implied covenant to drill an exploratory well. And I mean an exploratory well, which is commonly known in the industry as a wildcat well. We use that expression simply because it's a shorthand way to express rather large point. Some brief statement of the background facts, I think, would be in order in an understanding of this implied covenants matter. Son bought this oil and gas lease from the Jacksons in 1938. It covers the Jackson Ranch in Chambers County, which consists of about 10,000 acres of land. Son first drilled two successive dry holes on this property and also ran a rather extensive seismic survey of this property, which is another exploratory device. It then drilled its number three well on this property in 1941 and discovered the oil field that's known as the Oyster Bio Field. It's been a very prolific field, one of the better oil fields in the United States. Sun has drilled a total of 66 wells on this lease. 50 of those 66 wells were drilled to develop the Oyster Bio Field. Now, 16 of those wells were exploratory wells, drilled outside the Oyster Bio Field, but still on the area covered by this Jackson Ranch lease. Of the 16 exploratory wells, only four found deposits, new deposits of oil or gas outside the Oyster Bio Field. And in all four of those cases, the production didn't last very long. But the other 12 exploratory wells were dry holes. In addition to that, in the exploratory area, Sun has either conducted or acquired from others a total of 14 seismic surveys of this ranch property through all of these years since this lease was acquired. And all told, these seismic surveys, each one in turn, as time goes on, being state-of-the-art, and this art has gradually developed and improved. The technology has improved with the passage of time, as is the case with so many technical matters. But through the years, these seismic surveys have covered the entire ranch property. That's just some brief idea of the exploratory effort which has been conducted by Sun on this property. Now, as of about the time of the trial of this case, in 1984, Sun had produced from this property a total of about 110 million barrels of oil and had produced a total of about 110 billion cubic feet of gas. At the time of the trial, the field was still producing about 2,900 barrels of oil a day, and it was still producing about 7 million cubic feet of gas a day. Looking at it from the royalty owner's point of view, and all of this is in the record, of course, during the 10 years before the trial of this case, just the 10-year period before the trial of this case, Sun had paid for the royalty owners as royalty a total of about $42 million. Now that's an average of about $11,000 a day, and at the time of the trial itself, Sun was then paying royalties on an average of about $14,000 per day. And I mention that fact particularly because, as the court knows, the implied covenant to develop, as it's been recognized by the cases in Texas and which the lessees accept as an implied covenant imposed upon them, is ordinarily put in terms of the lessee acting as a prudent operator for the benefit of both the lessee and the lessor. That'll give you some idea of the benefit to the lessors in this particular instance. Now, during the year 1979, Sun attempted to run another seismic survey, and the Jacksons at that point refused Sun entry upon the south part of this property, the part south of Farm to Market Road 1985, which runs across approximately the middle of this property, east to west. And that's when this litigation commenced. Sun filed for injunction and for declaratory judgment that its lease was still in force. It obtained a temporary restraining order, and it conducted part of that seismic survey. Later, Sun attempted to enter the same part of the property to drill well number 66 and was refused entry again. And at that point, Sun obtained a temporary injunction in this lawsuit and did drill well number 66 south of that road. At an expense of about $5 million, and for all practical purposes, it was a dry hole. It produced a little gas, but very quickly it quit producing and was plugged and abandoned. Now, in the course of that litigation, which is still the same lawsuit we're with here today, the Jacksons filed a counterclaim in which they sought cancellation of the lease on the ground of breach of an implied covenant to develop and an implied covenant to explore. We had a jury trial. Two main issues were submitted to the jury. Number one was whether Sun had failed to reasonably develop the property. Number two was whether Sun had failed to reasonably explore the property. The jury found that Sun had not failed to reasonably develop. In other words, it had reasonably developed, according to the jury. It found, on the other hand, that Sun had failed to reasonably explore. And, of course, the counsel for Sun objected to the submission of the second issue, the issue concerning exploration, on the ground that the drilling of an exploratory well on an oil and gas lease by the lessee is not a duty of the lessee, implied or otherwise, under Texas law. But the issue was submitted nevertheless, and the jury made that finding. The trial court judgment granted to the Jacksons immediate outright cancellation of this lease as to about two-thirds of the lease, about 7,000 acres of it. That was all of the lease south of that farm, the Market Road I've already mentioned, and all of the lease west of our parts of Bible, which is a stream running across part of this ranch. In addition, the trial court decreed conditional cancellation of the lease as to all of the remainder of the lease except that occupied by the Archer Bible field itself. And essentially, I don't want to get bogged down in the detail of this, but essentially the trial judge canceled that part too, effective about 9 months from the date of the judgment itself, provided that Sun could retain proration units in that conditional cancellation part of the lease if it drilled on a proration unit and completed a producing well. It could preserve that part of the lease from the conditional cancellation decree. The terms of the conditional cancellation part of the judgment were such that it was, for all practical purposes, impossible of performance, and no further wells had been drilled since the trial of this case. Now, the Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court as to every feature of the judgment except the conditional cancellation part of the judgment. The Court of Appeals held the conditional cancellation to be an unreasonable burden on Sun, and it reversed that feature and remanded it to the trial court for further consideration. And that's where we are now with this case.
What's the underlying reasons why the Jacksons wanted to cancel the lease?
Well, they don't express it in the record of this case. You mean beyond the legal reasons, Your Honor?
Such a good relationship, and you're paying them $14,000 a day. I mean, there must be some reason they want out of it.
Well, we've been considerably mystified about this ourselves through the years, Your Honor. I've got to assume that with cancellation of the lease, the Jacksons would see an opportunity to sell another lease on that property. The trial court, in its judgment, faced right up to the ruling of this court in Pittman against Coombs, around which this litigation completely revolves, faced right up to it, and in our assertion in this case, refused to follow this court's ruling in Clinton against Coombs by decreeing that there is an implied covenant burdening the lessee to drill exploratory wells. Now, Clinton against Coombs has said absolutely that there is no separate covenant to explore in Texas burdening the lessee as distinguished from the covenant to reasonably develop, which we all accept. And the premise of this is that there is no obligation on the lessee to drill wildcat wells. Now, the court, I emphasize that the trial court submitted that as a separate issue and regarded that as a separate covenant and faced right up to Clifton against Coons. The trial court told the jury, in effect, that there is such a covenant to explore and asked the jury to determine whether it had been breached. When the jury found the so-called covenant of exploration had been breached, then the trial court canceled the lease outright next to about two-thirds of its acreage. Now, keep in mind, Your Honors, that this was done with an alleged implied covenant where the express terms of the lease treat the lease, all of the leased acreage, as a single entity. It's a determinable fee simple title, which under its express terms is perpetuated in its entirety by production in paying quantities. The effect of all of this is that the trial court, and it's affirmed by the Court of Appeals, has regarded this implied covenant as a sort of a limitation on the title, so that the title, this fee simple, determinable fee simple title, comes to a complete end long before the express terms of the lease would say it comes to an end, by virtue of the breach of a covenant which this court has said in Clifton against Coons doesn't even exist. Now, the Court of Appeals has attempted to avoid Clifton against Coons in reasoning something like this. The court has said that the trial court used the terms develop and explore interchangeably. So even if there is no obligation to explore, that is, drill wildcat wells, there is an obligation to drill something called exploratory development well. And it said the lessee's obligation to drill an exploratory development well exists if there is a showing of reasonable expectation of profit. Now, it is clear from Clifton against Coons, and it's clear in industry practice, that an exploratory well is a well that is projected to a formation which is not known to exist or not under the lease or not known to contain hydrocarbons under the lease, where a development well is one that is intended to be drilled to a formation which is known to exist and is known to contain producible hydrocarbons under the lease. And no matter how the Court of Appeals identifies an exploratory well by calling it an exploratory development well, the wells that the court was dealing with in the record of this case were exploratory wells, wildcat wells, if you please, which Clifton against Coons held the lessee is not obligated impliedly to drill under an oil and gas lease. And the Clifton against Coons' rationalization of that is just as fair and just as reasonable today as it was in 1959 when that decision was handed down. There are various things wrong with this gerrymandered approach that the Court of Appeals has taken. One of the most obvious is that if the Court of Appeals really meant to abide by Clifton against Coons by reasoning that an exploratory development well it is truly a development well and therefore permitted in spite of Clifton against Coons, then under the jury verdict, we were not obligated to drill that kind of a well because the jury found that Sun had reasonably abided by the development covenant. That is, it had reasonably developed the entire Jackson lease. That's what the jury found. And so that's one thing wrong with the Court of Appeals approach. They're still dealing with an exploratory well, a wildcat well, even if they call it something else, a sort of watered-down name. But there's a more fundamental error in the Court of Appeals approach. The exploratory development wells, the court said Sun had failed to drill, were proposed to test for formations not known to exist under the lease, are certainly not known to contain oil and gas under the lease if the formations do exist there. And that's the very kind of drilling activity that was expressly covered by this court in Clifton against Coons, where the court said that the lessee has no duty to perform an obligation to drill that kind of a well. I want to yield the remaining opening time to my colleague, Mr. McCartney, who will discuss some other issues at this time.
Thank you, Councilman.
May I please report, as indicated, I represent Amico Production Company. My name is James McCartney, and I will address primarily the remedy aspects of this case, and if I have some time remaining, I would like to address a little bit further what we regard as the conclusive aspect of the jury's answer to special issue number one. But first, as the court knows, we're dealing here with a single lease covering approximately 10,000 acres. Further, the court knows that the trial court canceled unconditionally a substantial portion of that lease following the trial, and that aspect of the judgment was affirmed by the Court of Appeals. Now, what we want you to understand very clearly here is that these respondents, the Jacksons, are not asking this court to apply Texas law. This should be borne in mind. They recognize in their brief, the response to our petition, and it appears at page 51, that there are no Texas appellate cases which have approved unconditional cancellation of a lease or breach of an implied covenant. So they are asking you to apply the law of other states, and they're asking you to change the Texas law after it has been into effect at least since the landmark decision of Wagner Estate versus Sigler Oil Company. So that in itself is a remarkable request, but what is furthermore remarkable is that the Court of Appeals, in its analysis of this case, failed to recognize this very fundamental, well-established principle, and it cited, in support of the decree of unconditional cancellation, four authorities. And the irony is, or the anomaly is, that every one of those authorities repudiate and reject the concept that for breach of an implied covenant, the remedy of unconditional cancellation exists. And if I may just briefly refer to those authorities, because they are the focal point of this particular issue. The first one is Wagner State versus Sigler Oil Company, decided in 1929 by this court. It summarized the law of Texas to that date. It explained that implied covenants exist and that the remedy for a breach was damages, but it said in extraordinary, exceptional cases, this court could enforce the covenant. That's the point to remember. You can enforce the covenant by a decree of cancellation. But then it went on to say that that decree must be conditional, and it repudiated the concept of an unconditional decree of cancellation. Now, another authority cited was the case of Slaughter versus City Service, and that's interesting when you read that case. The court said there, and there the landowner sought an unconditional decree of cancellation. The court said they did not want a conditional decree, and the court concluded that the lessors, the Jacksons here, did not pursue a remedy cognizable under Texas law. Now this is the case that the Court of Appeals relied on for this concept of unconditional cancellation. They, in that case, cite the third case which the Court of Appeals relied on, which is West Tech Land Company v. Simmons, which says that in exceptional circumstances, a cancellation can be ordered, but the decree should be conditional. And then finally, the last authority is Williams v. Myers, and as the court knows, Professors Williams and Myers have editorialized for many years about the need for an implied covenant of expiration. their views have been rejected by this board and were specifically rejected in Clifton v. Coons. They've done the same thing with respect to unconditional cancellation. And even Williams v. Meyer, that section 845 says this remedy, that is remedy of unconditional cancellation, is regarded as unavailable in Texas. Now those are the four authorities which the court relied on for its conclusion. Now, what's the reason for that? The reason is adverted to by by Mr. Hoffman is that what we call a lease has been well established to be a conveyance of a determinable fee simple estate. That is to say, the grantee holds the estate and the minerals subject only to termination on the basis of certain events. And in Wagner and all these other cases, they identify the two events. One of them is the cessation of production and paying quantities. And the other is the total and complete cessation of the use of the premises for the purposes granted. And the court goes on to make it clear that it's not an improper use or an impartial use or a negligent use, but only a total use, which causes the termination of this estate. So we're dealing with title to land. And of course, the parties could agree to make the failure to perform any part of their agreement a condition to cancellation, but we're dealing with the standard oil and gas lease. And it's very clear, absolutely no question, but it is a determinable fee. Now, in the Wagner case, the court said, we're not going to imply a third limitation, and that is breach of implied covenant. You get that through damages, or if you can't ascertain damages, we will give you a conditional decree of cancellation. Now, what do the respondents say about that? They say, well, that's really not fair because we have to go through all the expense of the trial, and if we win, all we get is a decree of cancellation, and then the lessee can come in and drill. But that really, in this case, has even very little superficial appeal because of the facts which Mr. Hoffman has already recited to you. And then furthermore, when they entered into the lease in 1938, the law was well established, and it was well established that they could not obtain an unconditional decree of cancellation. And so they could have made whatever arrangements they made. They did not undertake to provide for this particular remedy. And it is, we submit to the court that the law of 60 or 70 years should not be changed. Now, just briefly addressing the conditional cancellation, the court below required, and the Court of Appeals reversed, the drilling of a substantial number of wells. In order for the lessee to hold his estate, there was no evidence in the record to support this. There's no claim that there's any evidence in the record to support this. All it amounts to is a punitive act. And here, once again, we're dealing in cancellation, conditional or unconditional, with enforcement of a covenant, not with penalties. And specifically, the question of what has to be shown in order to obtain a conditional decree of cancellation is set forth in the case of Bennett v. Lacey, which we cite, and which establishes very simply that first you've got to show a breach of a covenant. Secondly, you have to show that damages are not ascertainable. And then thirdly, you have to show what a reasonably prudent operator would have done, bearing in mind the interest of both lessor and lessee, and with a reasonable expectation of a profit. So what had to be shown is laid out in the cases, it's well established in the law, and we've cited those cases in our brief. Now finally, I see my time running out, if I may just address a point which was touched on by Mr. Popper. As we understand the respondent's position, they say that the implied covenant of expiration is a part of the covenant of development. And they say that repeatedly. And they say it in a number of different ways, but one way they say it is that in their supplemental brief is that it's recognized that the implied covenant to develop includes the duty to explore. So we have, even according to the respondents, this implied duty to explore subsumed in the larger covenant to develop. This is their concept. Now, what did the jury find? The jury found, in answer to special issue number one, that Sun had not failed reasonably to develop. And when they went along, with indulgence of the court, just about 10, 15 more seconds, if they went along and found they had not explored or any other component of development, we submit to you that that issue is immaterial, that there isn't any conflict. When they found Sun had not failed reasonably to develop the Jackson lease as an entirety, and the law is clear that you must look at these covenants as an entirety, then that concluded this case. The question and the issue was at an end. Thank you, John.
We'll hear from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Dick Watt will present arguments for the respondent.
May it please the court, I'm Dick Watt and I represent the respondents, OCR Jackson and other members of his family. I'm joined in my representation by Mr. Ernest Smith and my partner, Mr. John White. Today we have before the court an oil and gas case which construes and talks and speaks to the implied duties and obligations under an oil and gas lease. Of course, these duties and obligations may be explicitly bargained for by the parties, but what we're talking about today are the duties and obligations in case the lease does not explicitly refer to the rights and the duties and the obligations, which we don't have enforced in this case. This court, of course, is well familiar with this decision in the case of Amoco versus Alexander, where it said that an oil and gas lessee under the terms of the lease, in absence of an express statement, is obligated to do everything that a reasonable and prudent operator would do. And I think that the reasonable and prudent operator standard is much like the reasonable man standard in the court case, and it's been expanded. I think this is a commonly accepted definition that it's what a reasonable and prudent operator would do in the same or similar circumstances, bearing in mind the interest of both the lessor and the lessee. And it has further been grafted with an exception that if a reasonable and prudent operator is obligated to act, he will not be so obligated without a reasonable expectation of profit. These concepts were adopted by the early case of the estate of W.P. Wagner versus Sigler Oil Company back in 1929, and I don't think that there's any contention that could be made that from early on, as early as 1929, there's always been a duty to explore under an oil and gas lease in Texas that is implied. You must read the quote from Sigler, page 29, and this is quoted in our brief, but it says the lessee was under an implied obligation to continue with reasonable diligence during the five-year term as well as thereafter the work of exploration and production. So there's a manifest evidence that very early on this was always a duty under the oil and gas lease in Texas. Now, let's get to Clifton versus Koontz, which was decided by this court in 1959. Clifton involved a 350-acre tract up in Wise County, and just for illustration purposes, on this map of the Jackson lease, I have put the Clifton tract in red up there just so you can get some idea of the size of the Clifton tract as opposed to this tract. But in the Clifton case, and on page 25 of our brief, there's a little diagram that shows what happened to Clifton. There was one well on this 350-acre tract, and it was producing from an interval between 5,300 and 5,600 feet, called the Copa Conglomerate. And Mrs. Clifton was the landowner, and she wanted a second well drilled and she wanted the first well reworked. And so to prove that the lessee in that case, Mr. Koontz, had not been acting as a reasonable prudent operator, she put on a geologist, Mr. Kadane, who testified as follows. He said, "I have drilled the sites well, which is about 2 miles to the north of the Clifton Tract." He said, "When I drilled the sites well in the Strong Formation, which is above the producing formation, I saw it show. And then I think that there would be a likelihood in the Marble Falls and the Ellenberg formations on down below the Atoka that you might find something." And he went on further to say that if he had Mrs. Clifton's lease back, he had drilled a well. On that basis, the trial court entered a decree of cancellation, and I will concede in that case it's conditional cancellation. And that's what was reversed by this Supreme Court. And what the Supreme Court said was that in Clifton, and in all oil and gas cases, the Supreme Court said we're going to adhere to the reasonable and prudent operator standard in the case, which says that the duty to explore is part of the implied covenant to develop, but that you don't have to do anything unless there's a reasonable expectation of profit. And the Supreme Court said to Mrs. Clifton, that was not enough proof. All you said was that there was a likelihood and there might be something else and you might do something. And I would ask the court to compare that with almost the overwhelming presentation that we made in this case on expectation of profit. In Clifton, the court, and this is critical language, it's quoted in the brief, I'm going to read it again. It sets forth what you have to do to prevail in a case like this. It says that you have to prove a stratum different from that from which production is being attained in reasonable probability exists. Then you don't have to prove that you know it's there or it's certain it's there. You have to say that a stratum different from production is being attained in reasonable probability exists, and that by the drilling of additional wells, there would be a reasonable expectation of profit to the lessee. What Clifton does is lump all of the drilling obligations, and it does this explicitly by its own language, under the implied covenant of development. It says that everything is governed by the reasonable and prudent operator standard, which requires a reasonable expectation of profit. So if you're going to prevail in one of these cases, you better prove a reasonable expectation of profit, which we did in this case. In 1956, there was a case called Willingham versus Bryson, which is cited in the brief, and it was the focal point, and it was the concern of Clifton Court. In the Willingham case, the court had adopted the theory of there being a separate implied covenant of exploration, totally apart from the implied covenant of development. And it had relied upon a law review article by Williams and Myers in doing that. In the Willingham versus Bryson case, under proof very similar to what Mr. Clifton tried to adduce in Clifton versus Coons, said there is an absolute duty to explore without proving a reasonable expectation of profit, and we're going to cancel the lease. Well, in Clifton versus Coons, after the language that I quoted above, the court goes on to what's been called the Clifton exception, and that is, of course, quoted in the brief, and it is the exception that says, after talking about the reasonable covenant of development, which includes looking for strata different, which in reasonable probability exists, it says that we don't have before us here a large tract of land or which is a long period of time, and the rules might be different if we did. In other words, they're saying we might relax the requirement of proving a reasonable expectation of profit, but that wasn't before the court and they didn't decide it. Then, in the Clifton opinion, they turned to the implied covenant of exploration that had been adopted by Willingham versus Bryson and had been proselytized by Professor Williams and Professor Myers. They say that Texas doesn't adopt that. You've got to prove a reasonable expectation of profit. We're not going to adopt one that says you have a duty to explore no matter what. A lot of the confusion that emanates from the Clifton versus Coons opinion can be resolved if you understand when they say implied covenant of exploration, they are referring to the one which had been upheld in Willingham versus Bryson, and they're saying we don't have one like that in Texas, but they're never saying, in fact, they use the very term exploration, they never say there's not a duty to explore. One portion of Clifton versus Coons opinion is noteworthy. And this is at the very end of the opinion of page 696. And it says, petitioners argue that the lease involved expressly provides for exploration. and then goes ahead and says that there's no duty to explore. What this has reference to is the granting clause of the oil and gas lease. In other words, almost every oil and gas lease you'll ever see grants the lessee the right to explore, produce a laundry basket full of various things. And lessors in Clinton, just like the lessors in the case of Lobby versus Magnolia, which Sun cites in their brief in the line of funding, tried to bootstrap himself into an absolute duty without expectation of profit by saying, if that language is found in the brief, that creates, or in the lease, that creates a duty to explore. And that is what the language at the bottom of Clifton opinion at page 696 has to deal with. It has nothing to do with the law of implied covenants, which is before us today. Any doubt that that is what Clifton means, in my mind, is immediately resolved by the case of Pan American versus Belmont, which was written by Judge Langdon when he was on the Court of Appeals down to El Paso in 1960. In Belmont, in page 453, this language is found. The covenants impose an obligation to reasonably explore and develop. Couldn't be clearer. Judge Langdon goes a little bit farther then and lays out the requirements of a lessor in a case like this, and these are this is essentially the same thing Clifton says. It follows Clifton right along the board. And it says four things, and this is at the bottom, or in page 455 in Belmont opinion. First thing it says is that the lessees fail to measure up to the standards of a prudent operator. Now, the Jacksons proved two things in this case, and it often gets confused. First thing they proved was that the Sun was not acting like a reasonable prudent operator. They were not doing the minimum threshold acts to ever make a decision whether or not to drill. In other words, they had not done the things that would enable them to know or not to know what to do. And that is what number one says. The lessees failed to measure up to the standards of a reasonable prudent operator. And the Jacksons at trial proved four specific things that Sun failed to do in this matter. And I'm going to go through them very briefly. One is the use of seismic and geophysical surveys. You've heard Mr. Hoffman say that Sun adopted state-of-the-art methods. You need only read the testimony of the Jackson's expert to see that this was sharply disputed. And in fact, he said that they did not use seismic in a manner that a reasonable prudent operator would do it. It would be like this were a medical malpractice case. And the plaintiff said the doctor did something wrong. And the doctor said, I took x-rays. And the plaintiff said, yes, you did take x-rays, but you took the x-rays at the wrong time, and you forgot to read them. That's what we're saying about the seismic in this case. Second thing that Sun failed to do was to use realistic economic criteria. The third thing that Sun failed to do was farm out the lease in a reasonable and prudent manner. And you know from the Belmont versus Pan American opinion that a farm out is an exploration tool. And I agree with Sun in their brief when they say that a lessee doesn't have an obligation to farm out a lease. You don't.